Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thanks for tuning in to episode 86 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe, that's crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion or like us or both at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. You can listen when we're first broadcast at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm. Or a day or two later, you can download us using iTunes or other podcast programs. And I won't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, what you think about it, if you have any suggestions for guests. And if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some of your non-mainstream ideas, and especially for the challenges you get to others. Today, in a couple of minutes, I will be interviewing David Christopher of openmedia.ca, a Canadian organization similar to the Electronic Frontier Foundation in the United States. We'll be talking about eavesdropping by police and intelligence services, and also the impact of the Trans-Pacific Partnership on Internet users. We only had a little bit of time to discuss the very important issue of freedom of speech, which is a real interest of mine, and I honestly don't know where the boundary is between absolute freedom of speech, which would allow some crazy things to be said or expressed in other ways, or censorship. I lean towards freedom of speech, but I'm not sure there's an absolute right, and if there are any infringements on the right to freedom of speech, they have to be applied fairly and evenly. This interview with David Christopher is relatively short, so after that I'll cover some other issues, particularly the freedom of speech that we're not able to get to in the interview. So don't go away as soon as the interview is done, but stay with us for the rest of the show. Thank you. David Christopher is the communications manager of an organization called openmedia.ca and blogs regularly for the organization. He's from the west of Ireland and holds a degree from Trinity College Dublin, where he studied history and political science. He worked in communications in New Zealand, Northern Ireland, and Scotland before moving to Vancouver, Canada. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you very much indeed for having me, David. It's a real pleasure.
I guess there won't be any confusion if I call you David and you call me David. Hopefully not. What kind of media does openmedia.ca intend to protect?
We are essentially a digital rights organization, and we exist to safeguard the possibilities of the open internet. We break that down into really three key areas that I think are particularly topical these days. The first is ensuring that the internet is affordable and accessible to everybody, whether here in Canada, but also around the world. The second is ensuring that the internet is surveillance-free, which of course is especially a concern in light of the all the Edward Snowden revelations and the many other stories that we've seen about government surveillance. And thirdly, we want the internet to continue to be a place where people feel free to express themselves and to share and collaborate online without fear, for example, of overly restrictive copyright rules impeding free speech. Oh. So it's really those three pillars that are the focus of our work.
Okay, well, I want to talk about all three of those. The first one, I think people call this net neutrality, and I've always had a little bit of difficulty understanding net neutrality. Like, if I pay my ISP for the cheapest internet and I get 1 megabit per second and my next-door neighbor gets 1 gigabit internet, why shouldn't he be able to pay for better access than me?
I think in terms of deciding what speed you want to get on your internet connection and paying, you know, the appropriate amount for that, that's really a decision that the customer makes. And we don't really have a problem, you know, with, for example, an internet company offering different speeds at different price points. Where I think there is a lot of real concern around net neutrality is that you should get the speed that you pay for. It shouldn't be up to your internet provider to speed up and slow down certain websites depending on, for example, the relationship that your internet provider has with those websites. Really, once you pay for a given speed, if you're paying for 20 megabits a month download speed, you should be able to access the entire internet at that speed. And of course, this was the subject of a really crucial, long-running controversy in the United States. Really turned into one of the largest campaigns in online history, really in political history as well. And it ended up in a really big win for internet users.
Which surprised a lot of people, because Tom Wheeler at the Federal Communications Commission comes from a background of being a telecom industry lobbyist. So
yeah,
that was kind of surprising. Is media consolidation a concern? Because often in both Canada and the United States, you're dealing with the ISP, the company that provides you with DSL or fiber or cable internet, also might control a lot of content, might be producing content, might be, say, competing with other content providers like Netflix that don't provide you with the connection.
Yes, certainly. We're very concerned about the amount of power and control that's taken up by just really what the tiny handful of large telecom conglomerates. Here in Canada, and in other countries too, but Canada's got a particularly, I think, a bad case of this disease where, you can look at the wireless market, for example, just three companies, Bell, Rogers, and TELUS, control over 90% of the wireless market.
And soon it will be four, but that will be the major cable provider in Canada.
Yes, for a long time, Wind was the sort of the smaller independent, the kind of the plucky underdog in the market, but they have recently been acquired by Shaw, which of course is well known out here in Western Canada, the fairly high-priced internet provider. So it does look like the big three are about to become the big four, but
yes,
that problem of market concentration remains. A very similar story when it comes to wired internet as well. It's often, people's choices are restricted. The big companies control a very large percentage of the market and are often trying to use regulatory shenanigans, really, to try and crush their smaller competitors.
It used to be that all an ISP was really doing was you had a modem and you could dial up to any ISP, but now the ISPs tend to provide the wire, whether it's a fiber, which I guess isn't really a wire, or it's the telephone line for DSL, or it's the cable for cable television, and a small player can't really get into the game unless they actually provide that infrastructure, can they?
Has been a long-running problem, certainly here in Canada. Open Media really got its name, I think, really became well-known here over what was known as the Stop the Meter campaign. It was a proposal by Bell and the CRTC at the time, which was very close to the big telecom companies, that would have effectively crushed the independent internet providers and also installed what amounted to a pay meter on people's internet connections. We saw 500,000 Canadians come together to overturn that. As a result, we did win open access rules that do allow smaller providers, I'm thinking the likes of TechSavvy, Distributel, there are a number of others, to have access to the networks that are, currently controlled by the telecom giants. One of the really big campaigns at Open Media we're doing right now is about whether those rules will also apply to fiber internet. Fiber is really going to be the future of online access. You can easily imagine 5 years down the line, a standard, what we would consider an average connection now of like 20, 25 Mbps would be almost seen as like dial-up. We really see people wanting to move to fiber, and it's crucial that they be able to access fiber internet through these smaller independent companies. So there's a really crucial decision on the plate of the new government, the new federal government, the new innovation minister, Navdeep Bains, in particular, that's going to decide, what those rules are going to look like. That's really going to be key. I think.
Right. And so you're basically trying to separate the actual transmission physical medium from the provider of your email services and whatever other things the ISP provides.
Oh, I think certainly it should be up to the individual customer to decide. You know, many people would like to get their internet service from one company, but perhaps get their telephone service or their email service or any other online service from a variety of different companies. Again, we've got this very concentrated system here in Canada, where not only are the big telecom companies providing the internet service, they're also providing TV, wireless, mm-hmm. And they even to the point where they own, many of them own, major media networks. So Bell, for example, owns
CTV, right.
Rogers owns City TV, Shaw owns Global. really, the only big guy, the big company that doesn't engage in that is TELUS. They don't have a sort of a media company
right.
under them. But that just sparks concern, you know, just a small handful of companies having so much power over the information we receive and how we access it.
I don't know if it's still true, but, I mean, wasn't the Globe and Mail owned by Bell at one point, too?
It was part owned by Bell, and I think that has, a couple of months ago, that changed, and Bell no longer have a stake in the Globe and Mail.
Yes. Okay, well, talking about a surveillance-free internet, are you saying that the police, the RCMP, our intelligence agency, CSIS, should not have the capability to intercept anybody's communication?
Oh, no, I think there are certain circumstances in which it's perfectly justified for security services to want to place individuals or organizations under surveillance. But the key is this must be done with proper oversight. There must be safeguards built in. And, you know, the biggest safeguard is that they should need a warrant signed by an independent judge in an open court in order to place someone under surveillance. That's been the way that, I guess, surveillance has worked for decades before the invention of the internet. Sadly, what we've seen, what we know from Edward Snowden, mm-hmm. is that many spy agencies here in Canada, their partners in the US and the UK and elsewhere, have really taken advantage. They're kind of exploiting the fact that so many people are online these days and the fact that our privacy laws have yet to catch up. And they're using the internet as something it was never intended for. They're basically trying to use the internet as a massive surveillance tool. They're putting entire populations under surveillance, collecting deeply revealing personal information on everybody.
So give me some examples where you think that hoovering up a certain person's communications could cause that person harm, even though they're not doing anything wrong at all.
Oh, I think there have been some actually just really concrete examples that were revealed last year out of Ontario, where people who had non-criminal interactions with the police in Ontario were having information about those interactions recorded on the police database, but then also shared with the American, with a foreign government, border agencies and the police agencies down there. And this caused really dramatic impacts on people's lives. You know, one person involved was a businessman, I think over a decade ago. He was involved in, he may have had a mental health issue that involved the police at the time. And because of that, because that was recorded and then wrongfully shared with the U.S., he ended up being denied entry to the U.S. Now, this guy is now a successful businessman. Most of his clients live in the U.S.
Right.
So it's had a really negative impact. You can just imagine now he's
no
longer able to travel there. So certainly inappropriate sharing of personal information can have a very real effect on somebody's everyday life, on their business. And you can just imagine the amount of our whole day-to-day lives are available online now.
Pretty much. Our health, talking to people who may be, maybe people in a place where, like Syria, where a conversation could end up with somebody ending up in jail or being killed because they're a dissident or they're on the wrong side or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there's been illegal intercepts occurring in Canada by the police and or intelligence agencies?
I think it's pretty clear that many of the activities that have been going on are not consistent with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Our friends at the BC Civil Liberties Association actually have a case before the BC Supreme Court at the moment challenging the CIC spy agency's collection of what's known as metadata.
Mm-hmm.
It can often be like the header information on an email. When collected in bulk, it can be really revealing. They're challenging that collection as being unconstitutional under the Charter. Now, of course, the legal system being what it is, those kind of appeals take time to work through the courts. A big part of the problem has been the lack of independent oversight of these spy agencies, whether it's the CSC or whether it's CSIS. We're left, you know, relying on the likes of Edward Snowden, on whistleblowers like
right.
him, for information about what our own security agencies are up to, despite the fact that they're being, you know, these spy agencies are lavishly funded with taxpayer dollars, and yet taxpayers are kind of being left in the dark about some of the activities that have been taking place.
So improving the legislation would mean nothing if you didn't improve oversight, because this stuff would just happen behind closed doors and nobody would know.
Oh, absolutely. We need a multi-pronged approach to this, David. I think no one solution standing alone is going to solve this. We really need to radically improve the oversight system, make sure it's properly funded, those people have the resources they need to effectively keep these spy agencies accountable to taxpayers. That's really just one part of the problem. I think we also really need to put a stop to this kind of blanket surveillance of entire mm-hmm. populations that's taking place without any kind of warrants and, again, without any kind of judicial oversight or involvement, and get back to that more targeted approach that only where surveillance only takes place with a warrant.
I mean, when you say certain populations, are there some communications in Canada that no matter who you are being intercepted, or are you talking about intercepting, say, Muslims or environmental activists or something like this? Is it that broad that it's everybody?
I think it's pretty clear from what we've known about what the NSA are up to, and of course, you know, the CSE works incredibly closely with the NSA, with Britain's GCHQ, with the Aussie and New Zealand.
And CSE is the
Communication Security Establishment.
Okay.
They're basically Canada's version of the NSA.
Okay.
They don't just work in almost, they're not just partners with the NSA, it's almost like they form a singular entity. And it is pretty clear that the NSA have been engaged in monitoring internet communications on a vast scale, so completely indiscriminately just vacuuming up the personal communications of pretty much everybody. Compounding that problem, though, is we've seen a number of examples here in Canada of where specific groups have been targeted for additional surveillance. Most famously, was about a year ago, it came out that the RCMP had been placing a number of First Nations and also environmental groups out here on the West Coast who were involved in the whole Enbridge pipeline
mm-hmm.
issue. And when I say involved, I would emphasize completely democratically, you
right.
know, organizing peaceful protests, nothing illegal about their activities whatsoever, and yet these groups found themselves under really extensive, invasive surveillance by the RCMP. And most famously, there was a meeting in a church basement where you had these fairly elderly crowd got together to write, you know, homemade protest signs. And that meeting was spied on by the RCMP. So there's clearly a big problem, both when it comes to the mass surveillance and also when it comes to specific groups being targeted like that.
I guess if they sharpen the ends of their sticks that they're going to put the signs on, they could be quite dangerous or something.
Well,
Something like
I'd
that.
love to know how they justify that. And, you know, again, if we had proper systems of accountability and oversight, then the police would need to come up with a proper reason, a well-justified reason for placing any organization under that kind of surveillance.
Right. Canada's previous government was conservative, and it was very friendly with whatever the police and surveillance establishment, or the intelligence establishment, that was a Freudian slip, the intelligence establishment wants. The Liberal government was kind of in the middle, and there's this bill called C-51, which they've said they don't really agree with, but they weren't going to throw it out, the whole thing. So what's wrong with C-51, and what do you think the Liberals government, which is supposedly more progressive, is going to do about it?
Oh, that's a really great question. I mean, firstly, I mean, C-51, I think, has united so many people against it, just because it's pretty much one of the most extreme and poorly thought-out pieces of legislation ever to be passed by a Canadian parliament. It effectively places, it greatly expands the powers of the domestic spy agencies, especially CSIS. It even grants CSIS the ability to break the charter, to explicitly break people's charter rights. It effectively places law-abiding Canadians under a government microscope, and all of this without any additional oversight or accountability whatsoever. So we knew last year, you know, the Liberal Party were really split on this. In the House of Commons, they voted for C-51, but in the Senate, the Liberal senators, who have a much more independent relationship now with their central party, the vast majority of Liberal senators ended up voting against C-51. Mm-hmm. And we also know that when opinion polls were consistently showing that Liberal voters, you know, grassroots supporters, were just as opposed to this bill as were supporters of the NDP or the Green Party, which came out against it. So it's really going to be key. What we've been saying to the Liberals, who are like now looking at what they're going to do about this, it's going to be really key that they listen to Canadians. Over the weekend, I thought.
But tell me some specific things that are wrong with it. Like, does it allow the government to try to like disrupt your communications by pretending, setting up fake people to comment on your posts, things like that? Like, what are some of the things that are really bad with C-51 in your opinion?
Oh, certainly, yeah. There is quite a vague and worrying reference to empowering CSIS to disrupt the activities of target groups. Now, it doesn't really go into an awful lot of detail about what that means, but we have some very worrying precedents. You know, when you go back to before the days of CSIS, when security used to be being run by a branch of the RCMP, that branch was involved in all kinds of wrongdoing. I think most famously burning down a barn in Quebec where people were about to meet. And that those activities back then in the 1970s were also taking place under a framework of what's called disruption. So certainly seeing that word in Bill C-51 sparked a lot of alarm among privacy experts. I think the other, I remember, you know, almost a year ago now, reading through that legislation myself, and the one that really stood out for me was where it would give CSIS the ability to break someone's charter rights. You know, it actually, as the way the law is written, it places this bill passed through Parliament above the charter, which, you know, on the face of it, you'd think is unconstitutional.
Right.
But, of course, the problem with constitutional challenges is they take time to work through the courts.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on something like this, people's rights are being trampled on.
Well, give me an example of this. I mean, most people listening might not be familiar with the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, but mm-hmm. how could... you know, the RCMP or CSIS intercepting my communications, how could that violate my charter rights?
Because under the charter, all Canadians have a right to be secure from unreasonable search and seizure mm-hmm. of their personal information. So the best way to think about it is, you know, you live in an apartment or in a house, The police can't just walk into your home and start searching through your belongings, searching through your documents, without needing to go and get a warrant first. If they want to go past your front door, they, without your permission, they need to get a warrant in order to do so. Now, if you think of the Internet as being like your digital home, then the personal information that you store online or that you communicate online deserves the same protections. In other words, to be obtained by the security agencies, they should need to have a warrant signed by a judge with a specific target and with a jolly, you know, with a real solid reason to place someone under surveillance.
Right. I guess I can see lots of opportunities for harassment, at least. The guy who photographed man who was selling cigarettes on the streets of New York City, and somebody took photos of the policeman basically killing him. He's been arrested several times since then, which a lot of people think is pushback. And certainly if the police had access to your medical records and communications, to communications that might indicate your sexuality, things like that, then that could definitely be used to disrupt your life if they leaked it to the right people.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, it could go much further than that. I mean, the legislation actually specifies two things that the RCMP or that the security agencies aren't allowed to do, and that's like murdering someone or
sexually
assaulting someone.
And
that's actually in the legislation. They cannot commit murder or sexual assault against someone, but the fact that they felt the need to specify that is incredibly worrying, and it makes you think about all the other things that stop short of murder.
So they could beat me up. Right, because they didn't say assault was banned.
yeah, but you certainly have a right not to be randomly beaten up by security agencies under the charter.
Yeah, that's
any
okay. I agree.
So there's this huge conflict between. I mean, so much of C-51 seems to be unconstitutional on the face of it. It's also made a real dog's breakfast of our privacy laws and of our security laws. When you listen to experts like Professors Roach and Furkevi, who have done a really solid analysis of this, it's pretty clear that really what needs to be done here is go back to the drawing board, repeal this legislation, and then look at, you know, maybe there are common sense ways in which we do need to tighten up security, but we can do so while also respecting people's privacy rights and their constitutional rights.
And if I'm correct, I think in the United States, with all of this mass surveillance that's going on, they have not yet been able to come up with a clear example of a situation where mass surveillance actually stopped a terrorist attack. And in many terrorist attacks, the terrorists are using social media, text messaging, and other things that are really easy to intercept if you're paying attention.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think the classic example is unfortunately the tragic attack that we saw in France just a couple of months ago. And, you know, France has actually got some of the most invasive surveillance laws in the world. You know, the French government are allowed access to pretty much everybody's communications without much oversight or without a warrant. So, in a sense, in France, they had, you know, what's kind of the security people's dream system, and yet it completely failed to stop the attacks there. And you're right, they haven't been able to point to any real concrete examples of how this kind of mass surveillance helps increase security. And there are also a number of former NSA people, security experts who had been quite, you know, worked quite closely with the spy agencies, now saying that they've made a mistake going down this road of vacuuming up everybody's information.
Well, it's a mistake for everything except your budget. If you're the NSA, you want to increase your budget. You want to increase the amount of mass surveillance. But if, you know, targeted surveillance isn't as expensive, it might be a lot more effective. Oh, we've only got a few minutes left. I wanted to talk about free expression, but I think that's too big of a topic. So let's talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which affects Canada, the United States, and the other signatories. So when it comes to open media, what about the Trans-Pacific Partnership worries you?
Oh, we think it's one of the biggest threats to internet freedom that the world has ever seen. And, you know, this is something that we've been campaigning on for pretty much since the Trans-Pacific Partnership was first proposed a number of years ago. We're specifically concerned because it amounts to the U.S. trying to export its really quite extreme set of copyright rules onto the other 11 countries taking part in the TPP.
And this is to protect, presumably, their... I mean, Hollywood is a huge business for the United States, and copyright in the United States has been extended and extended. I think they call it the Disney regulations or something, because they want to keep Walt Disney's intellectual property under copyright as long as possible.
Yeah, the U.S. has long been notorious for having really unbalanced copyright rules. They just work for the big Hollywood conglomerates, and they don't work for smaller creators, smaller artists, or for, let alone for just everyday internet users who want to be able to share things online. So we're worried very much about the impact the TPP is going to have on free expression and on the issue of copyright specifically. Canada at the moment has a copyright term of 50 of the life of the author plus 50 years. Under the TPP, though, that's going to go up to life of the author plus 70 years. And that's going to have a really serious... That provision alone could cost the Canadian economy hundreds of millions of dollars each year, based on an analysis by the New Zealand government. So we're concerned about the economic impact.
Well, what about criminalization of copyright violations?
Yeah, and it's really the whole TPP, because it was drafted in such an undemocratic way, where you really only had the kind of the industry lobbyists and the government bureaucrats around the table. There was very almost no pretty much effective public consultation taking place at all. We now have these rules, like criminalizing small scale copyright infringement, that are being exported from the U.S. To the other TPP nations. And that's why we're really hoping that the Liberal government, which, of course, is not responsible for signing the TPP, this took place entirely under the Harper government, we're hoping that they'll pause and really look at this issue seriously and start to consult with Canadians from really across the spectrum.
It's going to be a big fight. The Liberal government just approved a major sale of military equipment to the Saudi government just after they executed 47 people in one day through beheadings and other gory methods of killing people. So it seems like the Liberals are putting the economy ahead of rights. That's the signal I got from that.
There are some worrying things, certainly, you know, that the Liberals have done. I think a lot of people are really thinking, you know, they've been in power for just a couple of months now. We're still really needing to get a steer about which way they're going to go on a number of these issues. Even if, however, their only concern with the TPP was the economy, there's enough evidence that the TPP is really going to have a negative impact on our economy and on our tech sector, our digital sector in particular. You've got Jim Balsillie from BlackBerry speaking out strongly, a number of other innovators and digital economy people warning about the impact this is going to have. So really, even if the only yardstick the Liberals used was the economic impact, I think there's enough evidence there to say that we should be really thinking twice about the TPP and pushing to get this changed and make it much more responsive to the public interest instead of just to the interest of a small, really an unrepresentative sample of a large industry conglomerate.
Yes. Well, I think we've run out of the time that you allotted to this conversation. Is there anything on the topics we've covered that you'd like to say to kind of round off the discussion?
I think it's, given that it's January, I just think it's shaping up to be a really exciting year. I've been working with Open Media for coming up on 3 years now, and I don't remember a time when there's so many key issues, live and on our plate, things like Bill C-51, like the TPP, like the future of affordable internet access. It's really going to be a really key year, I think, for digital rights here in Canada and also around the world.
Yes. Well, I think I agree with you. There's a lot of issues on the table. So if people want to know more about your organization, they can go to openmedia.ca. That's your website.
Yeah, we've actually got a brand new website at openmedia.org.
Okay.
So, yeah, people can check us out there, but also on Facebook and Twitter. We have a very lively Facebook community. There's always some interesting conversation going on our Facebook page. So, come check us out and learn more.
Well, thank you for spending some time with me today, and goodbye.
You're very welcome. It was a real pleasure. Thank you very much again for having me.
Okay. And I'll send you a link to the podcast, which will go up in about 1 week.
Oh, that would be great. We'd love to. We'll certainly share that out with our community.
Okay.
Okay.
Well,
thanks, David.
Have a great evening.
You too. Bye now.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, now let's discuss the issue of freedom of speech. David Christopher is a leftist. I'd like to start with an article from Russia Today, which was published on the 7th of January, entitled Blackface Backfire, the Pictures That Sparked a Hate Storm. A Hungarian journalist sparked the ire of the internet by publishing images in which she is morphed into a member of different African tribes. And the Russia Today article, which I will link to, shows 8 pictures, one with her actual white skin, and 7 other pictures with various shades of reddish black skin, and various cultural accoutrements, such as flowers in her hair and painting on her face and things like that. The 34-year-old describes herself as a human rights journalist. But when she put these pictures on the internet, people were quick to take offense, and Russia Today quotes a few people. This is blackface and insensitive. This woman did blackface to bring awareness to people that already exist and could have simply shared videos and pictures. Another said, blackface helps no one. What the hell were you thinking? These women were beautiful and dignified in their own right. Superimposing your face on theirs just serves to erase them from their own stories and foreground. Shameful. Well, we've heard a lot about racist Hungarians lately, such as the reporter who tripped an immigrant trying to evade border police, and the government is pretty right-wing. But in this case, we've got a woman on the opposite end of the spectrum, a human rights journalist, and she got into trouble on a website named Bored Panda, which I'm not too familiar with, although I have gone there to waste time a couple of times. I believe it's set up intentionally to waste people's time by putting fairly trivial things out there. But I actually think this woman had a message that's worth thinking. When you look at the 8 pictures of her with different skin colors and different cultural designs on her face and in her hair and things like that, you're looking at 8 different people just by changing her face and how she prepares her face and how she dresses. And I think that shows how shallow our perception of race is. It's really based significantly on skin color. And I encourage you to go look at the pictures and see what you think. Blackface was a problem because it was both a mockery of black people and also was an economic crime, because if people wanted to listen to something based on black musical traditions, the black musicians weren't allowed to play for white audiences, so people like Al Jolson, who commonly wore blackface, did it. But is it as simple to say that Al Jolson was an exploiter or an admirer of black music working in an environment he had no control over? What would have happened if he'd refused to do it? He might have lost his job too, and then somebody else would have come along, which I guess is no excuse, but it's pretty hard to see how he could have changed the system. The message that I got from this expression, which is, I think, how much our perception of race is based on color, could not have been produced by showing pictures of 8 different people. It was not an attempt, I don't think, to erase those people from the world. Those people wouldn't have been seen otherwise. I think it was an attempt to send a message about race. So I side with the Hungarian journalist. I think, like many things, there cannot be absolute prohibitions. If we have a prohibition on dressing up like Hitler, how could we do a movie about the Second World War? A lot of it depends on your attitude. If you dress up like another race to mock them, that's completely different than dressing up to honor them or to send some other kind of message. and maybe we should be trying to figure out what's the message, and do we like the message or not, and if we don't, maybe we should start talking about it. Plus, I think people need to lighten up a little, look at the context and fight the big battles, not get obsessed with what is, in this case, political correctness on, as I mentioned before, a website that's designed to waste your time. Anyway, if you agree or disagree with me on this issue or any other issue, let me know, and I will provide a link. A woman that I know recently put a posting on her Facebook page, which I reacted to a little bit because I thought it was completely impenetrable in the jargon that was used. I'll quote from it. Manarchists and brochialists are Manarchists and brochialists are quintessentially anti-intersectional. They have, quote, missed the destroy patriarchy memo. They dominate spaces, manipulate women, and dismiss identity politics as divisive. Typically, they are privilege blind, cliche white men, often significantly above the poverty line, e.g. Russell Brand. These people refuse to acknowledge oppression and privilege, intersectional or otherwise, outside of classism and socioeconomic status. In addition, manarchists and brochialists refuse to accept that within their own movement, as within society more broadly, there may be misogyny, from mansplaining to rape threats, resorting instead to the no true Scotsman fallacy by accusing feminists and other critics that they must be speaking to the wrong so-called socialists. And I asked for an explanation of this, and I was told to go to a webpage that would explain all. So I went there, and I got a little bit of an explanation. Brochialism and manarchism are umbrella terms for sexists within the radical left, specifically used for those who believe that the creation of a socialist, Marxist, or anarchist system will inevitably bring about gender equality, and that therefore no measures need to be taken other than the destruction of the hierarchy imposed by class. Manarchists and brochialists are quintessentially anti-intersectional. They have missed the destroy patriarchy memo. I think I'm repeating myself. So what's intersectional? These are people who live in a variety of categories. I suppose this could be somebody who is black and transgender or something like this. And they experience oppression or privilege based on belonging to a plurality of social categories. So my reaction to this was not so much the ideas, but the fact that I couldn't get into the ideas because of the terminology that was used, I think, to exclude people who aren't inside the club of people who want to understand all of these words with, I think, pretty vague meanings. There's a lot of words in the English language that can be used to communicate, and maybe we should try harder to communicate instead of inventing terminology. It's kind of ironic to me that a lot of this, what was being written, is about things that exclude people, but actually terminology is very excluding. And I think a lot of academics like to use terminology to protect themselves from the outside world, because if they actually write down relatively simple and clear concepts in a way that everybody can understand, two things are going to happen. First of all, they're going to get people from the outside world discussing things with them, which they might not want. And secondly, they might not look as important if the ordinary Joe can actually understand what they're saying with a little bit of work. I don't really believe either of those things, because I think when people can see something like the theories of Einstein written down in simple words, they realize the brilliance of what's behind those words. It doesn't take complicated words to express a brilliant theory. So people have the freedom, obviously, to express themselves in the most horribly complex and excluding way, but maybe we have a responsibility to try to talk to each other in the clearest possible way. And that is certainly what I try to do. Let me know if I'm succeeding. Glenn Greenwald published a really good article in The Intercept on January the 8th. Where were the post-Charlie Hebdo free speech crusaders as France spent the last year crushing free speech? It's titled his article. Greenwald says, many of these newfound free speech crusaders in the aftermath of the Charlie Hebdo killings were not authentic. Instead, they invoked the principle only in the easiest and most self-serving instances, namely in defense of the ideas they support. It was only a little while after the famous Paris March, in which governments like Saudi Arabia, which are really big enemies of free speech, participated, that the French government arrested comedian Dieudonné Mobala Mobala. They called him an apologist for terrorism after he suggested on Facebook that he sympathized with one of the Paris gunmen. 2 months later, he was convicted and received a suspended 2 months jail sentence. In November in Belgium, he was convicted of making racist and anti-Semitic comments in a show, a comedy show, and was given 2 months in prison. Glenn Greenwald asks, why were there no Je suis Dieudonné hashtags trending? Nobody really came out to defend him. The government also ordered prosecutors to crack down on hate speech, anti-Semitism, and glorifying terrorism. There were criminal convictions of activists with the so-called boycott and sanction movement against Israel. They wore T-shirts in a supermarket saying, long live Palestine, boycott Israel. It doesn't really matter what you think about these activists. You might think that they're totally wrong, but most people would say, well, they have a right to freedom of speech, and wearing a T-shirt, I guess, is a form of expression. The French government seized emergency powers in the after the Paris attacks that they said originally would last 12 days. They extended them to 3 months, and there's now talk of them being extended indefinitely. A lot of the attention was on mosques or other places where Muslims gather, but they also went after the climate activists. I have my own issues with climate activists jetting around the world, burning fossil fuels to go to nice places to discuss agreements that they know are completely meaningless. But still, I think most people would say they have the right to demonstrate in favor of their beliefs and ideas. Glenn Greenwald closes by saying, I'll quote this exactly, central to an actual belief in free speech rights is the view that all ideas, those with which one most fervently agrees and those one finds most loathsome and everything in between, are entitled to be expressed and advocated without punishment. I love the idealism of this, but I just feel that there are people who are going to say things that society cannot tolerate, and we kind of get around this by saying, well, if you show pictures of child pornography, then that's illegal because there are children having sex, and it's not the expression, but it's the actual act of producing it. But what if you were to do a cartoon with imaginary pictures of imaginary children having sex with imaginary adults? Would everybody be okay with that? Or what about literature or movies or whatever that glorifies and adulates some of the mass killers of the last century? Are there ideas that are so horrible that we should actually censor them? I don't know what the answer is. As I've said before, I kind of lean towards freedom of speech most of the time. I'm just not sure that the ideal of 100% freedom of speech to say anything you want would actually work. But it is true that in the guise of anti-terrorism, a lot of governments are actually cracking down on freedom of speech. I think Greenwald makes a really good point that people who really truly believe in freedom of speech need to step back and not just look at the easy examples. It's easy to say that the Charlie Hebdo magazine, no matter what you might have thought about some of the cartoons, has a right to operate without people being killed. I think everybody can agree on that. They have a right to publish. but we kind of put them on a pedestal as an icon of free speech, even though there's lots of evidence that they were biased against Muslims and censored themselves on other issues, such as relatively mild jokes about Jewish people. We need to think about people like the comedian Dieudonné. Many people might be very offended by what he says, but then most comedians offend people. And why are the governments of Europe spending so much effort trying to silence him, put him in jail, when he's just expressing himself through speech? As far as I know, he's not inciting anybody to go kill anybody. He's just expressing his opinion in a very harsh and probably very funny way. Definitely, if my French was better than it is, it's pretty pathetic. And I was in Europe, I would go to one of his shows just to see what all the fuss is about. Maybe in the end, the publicity of being thrown in jail will actually be really good for his career, so he might get the last laugh. Let's turn to the environment now. Paul Krugman in the New York Times talks about a Wall Street Journal editorial that accused President Obama of destroying 40,000 jobs in the coal industry. 40,000 have been lost in the United States since 2008. Krugman points out that the U.S. economy has added 14 million private sector jobs since 2010. He also points out that the Wall Street Journal has no truck with some of the problems with coal. A lot of people obsess about the CO2 that's produced by coal. But there's a lot of toxic materials that ends up in the atmosphere, and we're certainly doing a much better job of taking those out of the atmosphere. But what happens is they end up in what is called coal ash, which is highly toxic, and there have been a couple of major releases of coal ash into rivers into the United States. Mercury is one of the biggest contaminants, and that is a potent neurotoxin. And it's the same stuff they put in vaccines as thimerosal, so it must be good for you. Krugman asks a really good question. In what moral or economic universe is it wrong to limit the emissions of neurotoxins? And as coal fades away, so also will the terrible accidents that have occurred because of coal mining, the terrible health effects that have occurred to miners, and the massive releases of pollutants into the atmosphere and in the uncontrolled releases of coal ash, which have mentioned have happened a couple of times. Another recent paper in the journal Neurology looked at midlife milk consumption and the impact on Parkinson's disease related to pesticides, especially an organochlorine pesticide known as heptachlor epoxide, which is found at very high levels in the milk supply in Hawaii, or was in the 1980s. And not surprisingly, they discovered that people who had higher levels of this pesticide in their brains also had lower neuron density. Neuron density is believed to be a sign of progressing Parkinson's disease, and I've believed for a long time that Parkinson's disease is yet another disease of the modern world, exposure to compounds that interfere with brain function, such as pesticides, such as mercury, such as lead. And while we're talking about lead, let's turn to the issue of Flint, Michigan. As a reminder, in Flint, Michigan, where the city was put under an emergency manager appointed by the governor, the emergency manager decided to save money by taking water out of the Flint River instead of from the Detroit water system, which had been done for years. It was known that the water in the Flint River was corrosive. Apparently, General Motors no longer uses it to make cars because of the toxicity of water, which says something. Because it was corrosive, there was concerns about the water dissolving the lead in the pipes in many of the older houses in Flint, which would cause lead poisoning, and that's exactly what happened. The irony of this whole thing is that in order to save about $1.5 million, the governor and the emergency manager of Michigan have created a problem that is now estimated at a cost of $1.5 billion to solve so much for saving taxpayers' money. The reason I mentioned this is because there's a new film on YouTube, which was put out by the students of Davison High School in Genesee County, which is in the Flint area. And it's a really excellent, very well-produced video, and I encourage everybody to go and listen to it. Some of the voiceover is not professional. They're high school students, after all. But it's very well put together. It focuses very much on the timeline, on the chronology, which in this case is critically important. It's really a story of who knew what when. And I think that the governor of Michigan is now in pretty big trouble. There are calls for his resignation, even calls for his arrest. And of course, he now has Michael Moore, the famous filmmaker, going after him. Michael Moore is from Flint. He went to the same high school that this film came out of. So it's going to be an interesting battle between the penny-pinching governor and Michael Moore. Stay tuned for more on this subject. And finally, I'd like to get back to another Canadian issue. Canadians love to be superior to the rest of the world, such a wonderful country, best country in the world, people are so polite, etc., like that. And we have a new government which is claiming to buy into the best things about Canada, to emphasize the best things about Canada, and to stop the mean-spiritedness of the previous Prime Minister, Stephen Harper. We now have Trudeau number two in power, our own little dynasty. Justin Trudeau, the son of former Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau of the 1960s and 70s. The former government had approved a $14.8 billion deal that would sell what are called light armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia. And then Saudi Arabia went and executed 47 people in one day by a variety of brutal means. If they had been done by ISIS and televised, everybody would have been up in arms. They weren't all beheadings, but some of them were, including a very well-known Shia cleric who was, as far as I can tell, not a jihadi cleric, but he was advocating for the rights of the Shia people in eastern Saudi Arabia, which is where the oil is, and where the government tries to keep things under control because they want to keep pulling the oil out, and they don't want to deal with the rights of the people that live there. So one would have expected this new government to do something about this deal, but they just said, no, we're going to go ahead and we're going to sell $15 billion worth of armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia. Even though everybody knows that they're either going to be used to oppress the people of Saudi Arabia or to oppress people in Yemen. It's going to be one or the other. So much for Canadians holding their noses in the air and feeling superior. Thank you for listening to episode 86 of The Infectious Myth. You can access our archive of episodes at infectiousmyth.podbean.com. If you got a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us on facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.